Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 24, going to cover the entire chapter, verses 1 through 22. This chapter is continuing the last several chapters covering miscellaneous laws, and more importantly, the laws against divorce in the first four verses. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we looked at exclusions from the assembly and other miscellaneous laws. This again is in Moses' speech before his second discourse, before the Israelites on the plains of Moab, right before his death and right before they were to cross the Jordan River and to go into Israel. And so in his first discourse, he warned them against idolatry. In this, his second discourse, he is laying out what the law is. He's reminding them of what the law is and encouraging them to keep it. So we start now in verse 1, and all of this is God giving it to Moses. He's just relaying God's words to the people. Verse 1 through 4, Deuteronomy 24. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, and if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now these four verses have created a whole bunch of controversy and discussion, scholarly discussion. The laws about divorce, especially when concatenated with the New Testament statements about divorce given by Jesus. Well, I'm going to give it my best shot here. First of all, in verse 1, it says, when the married woman finds no favor in her husband's eyes. Well, if you have that situation and a woman finds no favor in her husband's eyes and there's no certificate of divorce required, then the husband could vent his anger upon the wife and she would have no way to escape. So this certificate of divorce is often looked at as so easy to get that it's a way of easy divorce and is favorable to a disgusting man who kicks his wife out. But on the other hand, you could look at it as something favorable to the wife because it gives her some legal protection, gives her sort of an escape valve when the marriage starts breaking down. The man just can't get mad and kick her out. He's got to go through a legal process here. Now, if it is true that an Old Testament divorce could be granted for any trivial reason, and I'm going to show you in a minute that's probably true, it is true, the question arises is why would the God-given Old Testament law allow that? Well, again, it's because the law permits things that God doesn't necessarily approve of. I mean, there's polygamy, there's slavery, there's warfare, there's all kind of stuff in there. It's not God's fault. He's just trying to regulate it. And I'm sure he's not in favor of divorce either, as Jesus said in the New Testament, but Moses was just trying to regulate it. And this requirement for a certificate was regulating the situation where men were just kicking their wives out in the streets. Here's what Adam Clark says about that, quote, "It is certain that a Jew might put away his wife for any cause that seemed good to himself, and so hard were their hearts that Moses suffered this." He allowed it. "And we find they continued this practice even to the time of our Lord, who strongly reprehended them on the account and showed that such license was wholly inconsistent with the original design of marriage." And of course, those are the famous passage, which I think I might quote here in a minute, where Jesus said, in the beginning, it wasn't so. There was one man, one wife, no divorce. Now, that gets us to the word indecency, the most controverted word in the whole passage here. The man has got to find some indecency in her before he writes her certificate of divorce. Now, the question is what is that indecency? Here's some options. He finds adultery in his wife. And that's the indecency. Well, that can't be because that was punishable by death. As Adam Gill says, you can't, if you find your wife has committed adultery, she's liable to be executed, not just sent out with a certificate of divorce. Option number 2, incest. This, of course, is illegal. Leviticus 18:6, none of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. That means to have sex with him. Well, they can't be for that, because that crime was punishable by death also. So it can't be adultery or incest. So what is it? Option number 3, something dishonest or immoral. Now, I don't know what that might be, this dishonest and immoral that doesn't rise to the level of adultery or incest, but that is a possible option as to what it is. The Shammai school of the Pharisees actually held to that, according to Gill, and I'm not familiar with their literature enough to know exactly what examples they gave of that. Well, here's option number 4, and this is the option I believe it is. Something trivial but unpleasant to the husband, as John Gill says. Here's some examples of what might fit that category. The wife going outside with her head uncovered. She might spin in the streets, spin her cloth, her yarn, in the streets. She might show her naked arms to men. Ooh, horrible. She might have her garments slit on both sides. Her voice might be sonorous and noisy. She might be washing in a bath where men were present, or where men used to be present. She might be talking with every man in the street. She might be joking with young men. She might have blemishes or warts upon her skin. She might have body odor. She might have a stinking breath. Well, the Hillel school of the Pharisees in New Testament times, they held this is what indecency meant, and so the divorces were being given for trivial reasons. I think that is probably the best way to go with this. I realize this is extremely controversial, but I think this is what Moses was talking about. Now, if a wife did one of these horrible things, had B.O. or whatever, and doesn't find favor with her, he writes her a certificate of divorce. Now, some questions arise here. Was self-help allowed? In other words, did he just write the certificate on his own? Say, here, wifey, here's the certificate. You're safe now. Leave. Or did the husband have to get the certificate of divorce ratified by the Sanhedrin? I think the latter is more probably true. John Gill agrees with that. He says, quote, a man might not dismiss his wife by word of mouth, which might be done hastily, in a passion of which he might soon repent, but by writing, which was to be drawn up in form, and, as the Targum of Jonathan before the Sanhedrin, in a court of judicature, which required time, during which he might think more of it, and either recede from his purpose before the case was finished, or do it upon mature deliberation and a firm resolution. In other words, the man just couldn't, in the heat of passion, write out a piece of paper and give it to his wife. He had to go to the Sanhedrin and get a proper legal document, which takes time, which keeps the man from acting hastily and rashly in the heat of passion and so forth. Next question. Was a woman allowed a certificate of divorce? The law is written in from the viewpoint of a man. The Old Testament scripture is silent on the point, but I think you could argue from analogy, you could reason from the text here that a woman would be allowed a certificate of divorce too. We actually read in Mark 10:12, this is Jesus speaking, if she herself divorces her husband, and that sounds like she's doing the divorcing, does it not? And if she herself divorces her husband and marries another man, she's committing adultery. So it sounds like she's the one that initiated divorce. So I'm going to assume that the procedure of getting a divorce was open to the woman as well as to the man. Now, this certificate of divorce performed two functions, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said. The first function was it forced a time of reflection and possible repentance upon the outraged husband. He might think, well, maybe her B.O.'s not that bad. Maybe she could take a bath and fix it. And, of course, the second function, as I'm saying, is it gave the wife legal protection. She'd be in limbo without it. She would not be married to her first husband because she got kicked out of the house. And she wouldn't be able to marry a second husband because the first husband says, I can't marry you. I would be a bigamist because you're still married to the first husband. And she says, no, I'm not. He kicked me out of the house. And the second husband says, well, how do I know that? And how am I going to prove it to everybody else? Legal protection, very necessary. Now, this certificate of divorce shows that divorce was present in Old Testament Israel. In fact, we see that in the law. Let's look at Leviticus 21:7. They, referring to the priest, shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to his God. Of course, the priests are held to a higher standard than most people. This is not referring to any old person can't take a woman with a certificate of divorce. The average Israelite could, but not a priest. Leviticus 21:14, a widowed or a divorced woman a priest may not take. Same idea, 21:14 in Leviticus. Leviticus 22:13, but if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or divorced and has no child and returns to her father's house as in her youth, she shall eat of her father's food. That just means a divorced priest's daughter could go back to her father's house and get the priest allotment with the tithe that comes from the Levites and the first fruits and all that stuff that comes into the temple for the priest. She can eat of it, but that shows that it's possible that a priest's daughter might be divorced. Numbers 30 verse 9, but the vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So they had divorce in the Old Testament, and it was quite easy to get, according to Deuteronomy 24:1-4. Now, we need to remember that Jesus toughened up the Old Testament law of divorce. In the Old Testament, divorce was allowed for a lot more reasons than in the New Testament, assuming I'm right about the indecency referring to body odor and other kind of trivial stuff. Now, here's the famous passage in Matthew 5:31-32. Jesus said, it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. He's quoting Moses. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reasons of unchastity, makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, here it's apparent that Jesus is taking the view that indecency in the Mosaic law was a trivial thing, so that means that if a man divorced his wife for that trivial reason, he makes her commit adultery when she goes out and remarries somebody else, because she's not really divorced from the first guy. She's legally divorced, but not in the eyes of God, if I can put it that way. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So a woman divorced so easily is not really divorced. And so if another second husband marries her, she's still really married to the first husband, according to the way God meant it for it to be. And so that second husband is committing adultery. And the wife, the divorced woman, is forcing that adultery. She's causing the second husband to commit adultery. Notice that Jesus does allow one exception, the reason of unchastity, porneia, sexual immorality, which, by the way, is more than just adultery. It could be homosexuality, bestiality, watching pornography, except they didn't have that back then. But if we want to make an application to today. Now, Matthew 19:3-9, Jesus deals with the issue again. Some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? Notice, for any reason at all, that would be what the Hillel liberal school of the Pharisees taught that Moses meant by indecency, any reason at all, bad breath, slit garments, that kind of thing. And Jesus answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, Jesus is quoting Moses in Genesis there. And so the Pharisees were testing him. They were trying to say, is he for Hillel or is he for Shammai? The Shemites say that you can't divorce a woman for any reason. You have to have sexual immorality. But Hillel says, you can divorce if she burnt your toast one time too many. And so Jesus is saying, you're wrong, Hillel, Pharisees, because there's no frivolous reasons for divorce, because the original plan in Genesis was that a man and a woman should be joined, and that's it. Verse 6, Jesus continues in Matthew 19, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. They, that's the Pharisees, said to Jesus, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and send her away? That's a reasonable question. Jesus says in verse 8, he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, sexual immorality, and marries another woman commits adultery. So there we see the reason for this law in Deuteronomy 24:1-4. It's because of the hardness of your heart. Moses is just trying to regulate a situation. He's not approving of the situation. My favorite analogy is a municipality allows prostitution within the city limits as long as it's contained within a red light district. That doesn't mean the city likes prostitution. It just means the city can't get rid of it, and this is the best way to contain it. Doesn't mean that they're in favor of prostitution, and this does not mean that Jesus was in favor of easy divorce, or Moses for that matter, but he was just doing what he had to do given the hardness of their hearts. Verse 2 says, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. Well, verse 1, it says the husband the divorcing husband puts it, the certificate of divorce, in her hand. And that means she, in her hand means she has got access to a legal document that will protect her. And then he sends her out of the house, as John Gill points out. This sending out of the house was necessary to show that the husband and wife were actually divorced. If she stays there and lives with him, it doesn't look like she's divorced. Now, the real interesting provision of this law is verse 4. Her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife. Now, that's interesting. So let's look at the situation. First husband divorces, gives her a certificate. The woman goes to second husband, shows him the certificate, says, I'm legally divorced now, I want to marry you. And so the second husband marries her. Then the second husband says, you know, I don't find favor in you any more than your first husband did, so I'm going to divorce you. So he gives her a second certificate of divorce. And the wife then comes back to the first husband and says, look, I'm legally divorced, I want to remarry you. Now, you would think the law would be in favor of remarriage. It happens a lot of times. I think Prince Andrew's just getting ready to remarry Fergie in England, as they got reconciled, decided they loved each other after all. And that gives you a warm feeling in your heart, despite the fact of all the accusations against Prince Andrew being a pedophile. But other than that, you think, well, good, the marriage is restored. But not so in the Mosaic law. First husband, once he signs that certificate of divorce, that's it. He's lost his wife, and he will never get her back. So we need to look at some possible options as to why this provision was put into the Mosaic law, verse 4. Option number 1. This is mentioned by John Gill and Kyle and Delitch. The requirement that the first husband could not remarry his divorced wife was to slow the first husband down when he decided to divorce his wife in the first place. He would know that when I sign this marriage, this divorce certificate, that divorce is final and I'll never see my wife again. And he starts thinking about that and he says, well, you know, she was really, really a good wife just because she has a little bit of B.O., just because she didn't fix my toast right. Maybe this is a little extreme. I'll never see her again. And what if I can't find another wife? So that would slow him down. And that, of course, would prevent a lot of divorce. So on the one hand, this Mosaic law was easy for divorce. But on the other hand, it was tough. It was strict. It was against divorce because of this provision that a divorcing husband couldn't get his wife back. Well, that's the first option, to slow the husband down. That's why no remarriage is allowed of the divorced wife. Second option, to prevent an adulterous second marriage. Now, this assumes that when the wife leaves the first husband's house and she marries the second husband, the second marriage is adulterous. Even though it's legal, even though she has a certificate, it's actually, in the eyes of God, adulterous. Now, some commentators say the law actually considered the second marriage to be adulterous because the reasons for getting the certificate in the first place were so trivial. But the law, nevertheless, allowed the certificate in those trivial cases in order to protect the wife. But that still doesn't mean a second marriage is okay. It's adulterous. So, therefore, slowing the first husband down as he contemplates not ever being able to get his wife back will protect the wife from entering into an adulterous second marriage. Now, that's just a different way of stating the first option, to slow the first husband down. That stops the initial divorce. And not only that, option number 2, it stops an adulterous second marriage. So, slowing the husband down stops divorce. It stops adulterous second marriages. Here's option number 3, why the first husband is not allowed to remarry his first wife. To protect the second marriage from interference from the first husband. Well, you can imagine the situation. First husband sent his wife out. She remarries second husband. The first husband's getting lonely. He's getting horny. Ah, no sex. No good food. My wife was pretty good. You know, he starts thinking like the Israelites when they were thinking about their land, their time in slavery. It was a time of going back to the land where there was milk and honey. And so he starts thinking about his wife and he says, you know, I want her back. So he goes over to the second husband and says, I want her back. Let her go. Oh, we have a little gunfight, maybe a legal battle, maybe some harsh words. Well, this idea comes from Gordon Wenham, the famous evangelical scholar. There's one problem with that view. In my opinion, it's a minor problem. But Gordon Wenham says this. We see from our passage that the law also applies to the death of the second husband. In other words, if the wife, having divorced the first husband and married the second husband dies, he doesn't put her away, but he dies, she still can't go back to the first husband. And so this rationale of preventing interference with the second marriage doesn't apply in that case because there's no second marriage. The second husband's dead. Yeah, that is a problem. So what's the point? I don't know. So what's the point of the provision that you can't remarry in the case of the death of the second person? Well, in my opinion, it's because the whole point of the prohibition against remarriage was to slow the first husband down from divorcing. Fourth option, the reason that the remarriage is not allowed is because it violates the incest laws. Now, this is something that only a scholar could come up with. Here's the way the argument goes. This comes from Wenham, not necessarily that he endorses it. Marriage in the Old Testament law was considered to make one's wife one's closest relative. So, first husband is married to his wife, and his wife is now his closest relative. She leaves, gets divorced, and comes back. If the first husband marries her, again, it'd be like marrying his sister because his wife is his closest relative. Well, I think that's a stretch. So we're going to go with the reason that there's no remarriage allowed for the divorced wife when she comes back from a second divorce is to make that first husband think, do I really want to get rid of my wife? Now let's look at verse 4, the end of verse 4. Let me read the whole verse. Her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, as we just talked about. Why? Since she has been defiled. Well, now the question is why would she be defiled? How does getting a second divorce, which is perfectly legal, how does that defile her? There's your problem. Now, Adam Clark solves the problem by saying this. The second marriage was indeed permitted legally, but it was not sanctioned by God. Again, the idea that the Old Testament law has a lot of stuff in it that is sanctioned and is legal, but it's not necessarily okay in the eyes of God. So she's defiled because she's still really, in the eyes of God, married to the first man. Just because she wore a dress with two slits in it doesn't give her the freedom to marry somebody else. If she does, even though it's legal according to the Mosaic law, is not legal in the eyes of God. So now she's committing adultery. By having sex with the second husband, she's committing adultery against the first husband. Jesus had that view, as we pointed out, Luke 16:18, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. Now, why would that be? Well, he divorces his wife because she has body odor, but she's still his wife because she hasn't committed adultery, and so then he marries another woman, which is legal under the Mosaic law, but he marries another woman. Oh, he's committed adultery because he's still married to that first woman. Jesus continues in Luke 16:18, everyone who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery. Again, this is looking at it from the woman's point of view now in the last part of the verse. She's divorced for basically ungodly reasons, but legal reasons. She had B.O., and then she marries husband number two. Well, she's committing adultery against husband number one because she's never really, in the eyes of God, divorced from husband number one. And let me put that in more elegant language from Adam Clark. God, for the hardness of their hearts, suffered them to put away their wives. Yet he considered all after marriages, in that case, to be pollution and defilement. And it is on this ground that our Lord argues in the places referred to above that whoever marries the woman that is put away is an adulterer. And Gordon Wenham says that it was a common view that the law regards the second marriage as adulterous. Now, I don't know what he means by the law where it says that. He might be talking about rabbinic law. But at any rate, it's adulterous, and rehashing what I said as an option before, that might be one of the reasons why this law prohibiting remarriage of divorced wives, it was designed to prevent adulterous unions. Because if you sent a woman out divorced, she would marry a second time, and it would really be adultery and not good. Or it could be the fact that the law itself, requiring the certificate, forcing the first husband to hesitate before he goes through the legal process of getting that certificate, that will slow down this woman rushing into the arms of a second husband for non-godly reasons because she had B.O. All right, I guess I should summarize all that. Moses, because of the hardness of his heart, allowed certificate of divorce. That would be, of course, to allow an escape valve for angry husbands to keep the wife from getting in trouble. It would also give him time to cool down. And if he decides to still go through with it, it's unfortunate. But at least the woman has a legal document to protect her so she can get remarried because she needs support in that society. She can't go out and get a job. Now, she remarries. She's really committing adultery in the eyes of God. But this is a concession, just like polygamy was a concession, to allow the woman to live, even though in God's eyes she's committing adultery again. And the Mosaic law was easy on men, giving them an easy way to give adultery, but it was also hard on men because of the fact that the man could not remarry his first wife after divorcing her if she happened to come back to him by the death or divorce of the second husband. Whew. Ladies and gentlemen, now we go to verse 5, Deuteronomy 24. When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Now, this provision of a newly married man which should not be called into the army to go fight, this policy was designed to avoid the sort of divorces we just talked about. A man could say, oh my gosh, I got to go fight in an army. That's a good reason. I think I'll divorce my wife. Nope. The law said, no, we're not going to make you go out and fight. We'll let you stay home with your wife. This is similar to our scripture in Deuteronomy 20, verse 7. And who is the man that is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house. Otherwise, he might die in the battle and another man would marry her. And of course, that would be very bad for morale if a guy goes out thinking about his fiance might be married to somebody else when he gets killed. Now, Deuteronomy 20 is for engaged men. Deuteronomy 24, verse 5 is newly married men, but the idea is the same. We want to get the family started before we get men involved in military activities. The man's got 1 year to be at home, this newly married man, to give happiness to his wife. Now, one time years ago, I heard it said that word happiness, as the King James put it, to cheer up his wife, meant to make his wife happy with sex. Sounds like some man came up with that idea. Well, I just assumed that was true, but none of my commentators mentioned this, and I looked through a lot of them, and finally I got on the internet. I couldn't find anything about that, and then I glanced down a list of all the uses of the word cheer in the King James Version, and I couldn't find any time that the word cheer meant sex. That might be a Christian urban legend, a Christian myth, but at any rate, however he was to give happiness to his wife, he gave happiness to his wife. One more example, folks, of how the law was looking after women. The reason I say that is because people always say, oh, the law is patriarchal. It doesn't give it a rip about women. It treats women bad. No. The law has got all kinds of provisions in there to protect wives. This certificate of divorce was a protection for the wife, actually. We go now to Deuteronomy 24, verse 6. Do not take a pair of millstones or an upper millstone as security for a debt, because that is like taking a life as security. Now we're going to get into some collateral law here. Debtor law. Do not take a pair of millstones. The NIV translates that as, do not take a pair of millstones, not even the upper one, as a security for debt. Now, to explain what the NIV means here, Gill says that the upper millstone was the least valuable millstone. It was shorter, it was smaller, it was lighter, and it rotated on the bottom millstone, which was fixed. And so the NIV is saying, look, don't even take the cheaper millstone as a security for debt. And a fortiori, you wouldn't take the more valuable millstone, but don't even take the cheaper one. Well, that makes sense, because you take one millstone, it doesn't matter whether it's the upper or the lower millstone, that the mill is not going to be good anymore, and the poor person's not going to be able to get food out of the grain. Now, why were millstones not allowed as collateral for a debt or security for a debt? It's because that is taking a life as security. In other words, if the debtor can't pay the loan back for whatever reason, he dies because he hasn't got any way to have food. Couldn't eat. Now, this is similar to modern laws concerning collateral. I remember one time years ago when I was practicing law, I looked at a list, and I don't remember whether it was exemptions for taxation purposes or whether it was exemptions for bankruptcy proceedings. You could declare all of the debtor's assets could be put into bankruptcy, but there were certain things it couldn't. I don't remember the exact context of the law, but I do remember reading the list in South Carolina law. There were things like the law said you can't levy on, that means take by legal process. You can't take beds. You couldn't levy on cooking utensils and things like that. So the law, the principle is still in the law today. We go now to Deuteronomy 24, verse 7. If a man is caught kidnapping any of his countrymen of the sons of Israel, and he deals with him violently or sells him, then that thief shall die. So you shall purge the evil from among you. This is a repeat of Exodus 21, verse 16. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. Now you say, why would somebody be kidnapping somebody? It's probably to make them slaves. I mean, that's how African slaves were taken. They were first kidnapped by their fellow Africans, other African slaves, and then they were sold to European slave traders. So all of the slave trading business was basically kidnapping, which of course is denounced as anathema in the scriptures, Old Testament and New Testament too, by the way. Paul mentioned kidnapping in a list of all kinds of sins like homosexuality, adultery, and so forth. Anyway, a kidnapper called a thief here, he's going to die, death penalty for that. Kidnapping is serious business, even in modern days. How many movies you watch about kidnapping? Serious business. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Now, I've mentioned in several previous audios all the times that Israel is said to purge evil. And I'm not going to read all the scriptures again, but we have an example of a rebellious son is purged by being killed. We have an example of false prophets and false dreamers getting purged by being executed. We've got the example of fornicators, engaged fornicators being executed and thus being purged as evil from Israel. Also, perjurers were purged by being executed. So the idea is to keep Israel holy as much as possible. We go now to Deuteronomy 24, verses 8 and 9. Be careful against an infection of leprosy, that you diligently observe and do according to all that the Levitical priests teach you, as I have commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way as you came out of Egypt. Now, first of all, the NASB has leprosy. The NIV note says the Hebrew word was used for various diseases affecting the skin, not necessarily leprosy. I note that the Holman Christian Study Bible translates the word as infectious skin disease. And Moses says, do all what the priests say about leprosy, which I'm not going to go back over. That was in Leviticus. And then in verse 9, he says, remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam. Oh, another good object lesson. If you recall, Miriam and Aaron rebelled against Moses, and God struck Miriam with leprosy, and she had to be quarantined for 7 days outside the camp. We read in Numbers 12, verse 14, but the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterwards she may be received again. Now what this means is, if a woman had to suffer public humiliation by having her father spit in her face, which is a terrible thing, well, she would have to be shamed. She'd probably have to hide her face in her house for 7 days and not go out in public again. There was some kind of set time of shame that a woman would go through. And what Moses is saying, look, if a woman got spit in the face and had to be humiliated for 7 days, well, Miriam did something a lot worse. She rebelled against me and against my leader of Israel. And so she's going to have to suffer some public humiliation for 7 days. And it all came about because of her sin. And of course, her humiliation was that she had skin disease for 7 days and had to be quarantined outside the camp because of it. We go now to Deuteronomy verse 24. Chapter 24, verses 10 through 13. When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge. You shall remain outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. If he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you, and it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. Now, this is an interesting provision of the law. We don't have this in modern law. I'm assuming the pledge here that it's talking about is a cloak. The creditor lends the debtor with the cloak money, and the debtor gives the cloak to the creditor to use only during the daytime, or to keep only during the daytime. Every night, the creditor's got to go back and give the security, the collateral, the cloak, back to the debtor. Now, this is a repeat of the law in Exodus 22, verses 26 through 27. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets, for that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. The purpose of the law, of course, is that the poor man will not be pushed to the edge of destitution to such that he can't live. He can't sleep. Freeze to death without the cloak. Now, the next question arises, well, then what good is the security if the creditor's got to give it back every day? Well, the rabbis were aware of that question, according to John Gill, and this is a couple of their answers. First, the rabbis say the debt wasn't released at the seven-year Sabbath. In other words, if a creditor was able to keep a cloak during the daytime, that was a sign that that debt was not going to be released at the seventh year. I don't believe that for a minute. I think that's a misreading of the law, but it doesn't surprise me given how creative the rabbis are. Here's another idea they came up with. The pledged good, the good with the security interest in it, could not be passed down to the children. The cloak couldn't be passed down to the children. Why? Because the estate, let's say the debtor is dead, the children are the estate has got to keep giving that cloak back to the creditor every day. Now that makes sense to me. And then of course, the creditor could then sell the cloak at the death of the debtor so he could get his loan back. Now that idea of the rabbis is pretty good if you ask me. I don't believe any debt was released at the 7-year Sabbath, but this idea that the debt kept the cloak as security from passing down to the children, that makes a lot of sense to me. And note that the creditor, by having the cloak in his hands during the day, that would give him evidence during the daytime that he had a valid debt, and that cloak belonged to him, not to the children of the estate. Verse 13 says that if you give the debtor, if the creditor gives the debtor back the cloak every day, it will be righteousness for you, righteousness for the creditor. Well, now that does not mean forensic legal righteousness. It means a righteous action, not justifying righteousness. Because we don't believe in justification by works, do we now? We don't believe in righteousness earned by good works. It just means this is a righteous deed that you do, not that you are holy before God. We go now to Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land in your towns. You shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry out against you to the Lord, and it becomes sin in you. Now these aliens, or foreigners, as the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it, who would they be? Well, they could be people just passing through, but it's most probably either a proselyte of the gate or a proselyte of righteousness. Proselyte of the gate is a proselyte who's just agreed to a subset of Israel's laws. I forgot which laws they were. Basically, he had to be moral, don't steal things. But a proselyte of righteousness had to go whole hog, had to obey every aspect of the Old Testament law, including circumcision. So it's kind of like a junior proselyte and a senior proselyte. You're not going to oppress those. Any hired servant. A hired servant could be a countryman, in other words, a Hebrew, or it could be a proselyte. You don't oppress them. You shall, and how, in particular, what kind of oppression should be avoided? Verse 15, you shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets. Now, workers were hired by the day. They were living hand by mouth. They didn't have a savings buffer in case they weren't paid one day that they could reach into their savings and get by. They had to eat every day, living hand to mouth. Now, by analogy, if the worker is paid by the week, well, then you pay him at the end of the week, end of the month. I remember my father had a construction business, and he hired a lot of laborers who were living hand to mouth. And he would tell me, you have to meet payroll. You have to. If you owe the government, you don't pay them, IRS. If you owe yourself, you don't pay yourself. If you owe a supplier, you don't owe the supplier. You pay your workers first, because they'll walk out on you if you don't pay. You have to meet payroll. And of course, a poor laborer is not going to have access to legal process. He's not going to have a lot of power. He needs his money. And so a just man will pay when it's due, not being late. Now, I guess an application of that, if you owe money on a note, pay it when it's due. On a house mortgage, pay it when it's due. Don't put it off. Don't let people look at you and say, oh, look at that Christian. I read an article one time that said that TV stations hate to sell time to TV evangelists because of all the customers they sell to. The TV evangelists are the ones that are always late in payment. Terrible witness. Pay your bills on time. Verse 15 says that this is such a big deal, the poor not getting paid on time, that he will cry against you to the Lord if he doesn't get paid. That reminds us of James 5, verse 4 in the New Testament. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields, and which has been withheld by you, cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord. Pay your workers on time. It's a simple message. Deuteronomy 24, verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. Now, this verse, of course, illustrates a very basic principle of modern law, is that you don't punish anybody because he's got a nasty father or a nasty son. You punish him for what he did. Our law is very individualistic, and actually, this is very individualistic. You get put to death for your own sin. Now, of course, this is not the way things are trending in America. Now, you get damned as guilty because of the color of your skin, because of what group you're in. I just saw a news story about a high school was deprived of its state championship in basketball, and all of its athletic teams were no longer allowed to compete because of a game in which they played against a predominantly Hispanic high school. And some idiot comes into the stands. He was a critical race theory advocate, ironically enough, and he had tortillas. And he gave the tortillas to the people in the crowd, and two 14-year-olds, with all the maturity that a 14-year-old might have, threw the tortillas up in the air, and the idea was this is showing disrespect to that Hispanic school. Well, all hell breaks loose. The high school team, who had nothing to do with throwing the tortillas, they were labeled as racist, and their championship was taken away from them, and it was a big mess. And one of the school board members said, well, we don't have individual justice anymore. Everybody is guilty if they're in a group. And, of course, the group now is if you're white. That's the group that you're in. Used to be if you're black, then you're automatically guilty of whatever happens. But now it's if you're white. Folks, that ain't justice. Justice is individual. I can't emphasize it enough. Ah, but you say, what about all those other scriptures that say that children are punished for what their fathers do? That's not individual justice. I'll get to those in a minute, but let me read you another scripture that emphasizes the idea that Old Testament Jews were only guilty for what they did, not for their fathers or not for their sons. Ezekiel 18, verses 2 through 4. What do you mean by using this proverb concerning the land of Israel, saying the fathers eat the sour grapes, but the children's teeth are set on edge? As I live, declares the Lord God, you are surely not going to use this proverb in Israel anymore. Behold, all souls are mine. The soul of the father as well as the soul of the son is mine. The soul who sins will die. Not the father, not the son, but the soul. So somebody, there was a proverb in Israel that had the idea that all the children would suffer what the fathers do. And Ezekiel was saying, well, actually, the Lord God was saying through Ezekiel, no, it's not going to be that way. It's going to be individuals suffer. Now, having said all that, what about the scriptures that seem to say otherwise, that the sins of the fathers are visited to the third and fourth generation, so therefore the sons are punished for the sins of their fathers? Let's read some of those scriptures. Exodus 20, verse 5. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, not worship idols, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. Exodus 34:7. He who, that's referring to God, keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Now, that looks like at least an apparent contradiction. Here are some options to reconcile. I've got four. Option number one, these verses that say the children are punished assumes the children repeat the sins of their father. Adam Clark says this, quote, this necessarily implies, these verses, if the children walk in the steps of their fathers, for no man can be condemned by divine justice for a crime of which he was never guilty. Well, that's the easiest way to reconcile it. Sure, if the children are doing the same thing the father's doing, they're going to get punished. In other words, what the law would be saying is don't think just because your children and grandchildren the third or fourth generations away that they're going to get to do idolatry. Nope, same punishment is going to happen to them. Well, that's one way to reconcile these two sets of scriptures. Option number two, the generations are so tight that if a father or a grandfather or a great-grandfather is punished, so is the descendant. In other words, this is John Gill. In other words, if a descendant is punished, he is punished by being in the same family. Excuse me, let me say that again. A descendant is punished by being in the same family with the punished ancestor. The descendant is not punished in his own time. Rather, he suffers vicariously as his ancestor is punished. So what we read here is, for example, Exodus 34:7, the iniquity of the fathers is visited with punishment, and in the very act of doing that, the children and the grandchildren are punished right then, not three or four generations later, but right then they're punished. Well, of course, that would have meaning for a society not such as ours. We don't think that way. That's that idea of the community of the generations is alien to our individualistic societies. The NIV Study Bible says, but maybe we can put ourselves in the shoes of those back then. That might be a good way to reconcile. I don't think it's the best way. Option number three, the children are punished not judicially, but from the lack of blessings that would have flowed had their ancestors flown right. So in other words, the ancestors are punished, and let's say they're alcoholics, the alcoholism passes down to two or three or four generations, and the children are punished. Now that's true in real life. We see that all over again, both positively and negatively. A lot of times you have dedicated Christian missionaries. I remember one time hearing a statistic of how many missionaries had parents and grandparents who were dedicated Christians. Took two or three generations to get somebody with enough character to be a missionary, which is a hard thing to do. And that's on the positive side. On the bad side, how madness passes down sometimes through the generations, alcoholism. So if you take the punishment as not being judicial punishment, but rather just punishment because of life situations coming on the children, then the situation is reconciled. Everybody will suffer for his own sins judicially, but blessing-wise, that can pass down to the kids. Again, I don't think that's the best way to reconcile it, but it is a way. Now, here's a way that I really don't agree with. This is from John Gill. The law saying that every man shall die for his own sins, that was a law binding the court system, the judges. But the scripture that refers to judgment coming on the children and grandchildren, that's referring to God. God can do any kind of judgment he wants on the descendants because he's God and he's not limited. Well, I don't like that. It doesn't make God seem too just to me. So I'm going to go with the easiest option, which is, yes, assuming the children repeat the sins of the grandparents, are they going to get punished in the same way? They're going to get punished for their own sin. But it's so easy to read that verse in the wrong way. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, it sounds like these are the innocent children, and they're getting blasted for what their fathers did. Well, I mean, you could look at Adam. He's our ancestor, and we're suffering for it because we're in Adam. But that's not a judicial thing. That's a theological thing. Moses here is talking about the court processes. We go now to Deuteronomy 24, verses 17 through 18. You shall not pervert the justice due an alien or an orphan, nor take a widow's garment in pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. What thing? Well, don't take a widow's garment in pledge. Now, this shows that it's not beneficial to strictly take legal rules and apply them willy-nilly, because normally you could take a garment in pledge, but not a widow's garment. Why? Because she needs it. She's poor. And the law takes care of widows and orphans, as we know. Job 24, verse 3 says this, they, referring to bad guys, they drive away the donkeys of the orphans. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. So it's not just the widow's garment that's referred to, but the widow's ox. And I assume that you can make an application from the law, not just a widow's garment, but her pledge, lay off of a widow. She has got no means of supporting herself. Now, you might argue, well, by refusing to allow loans to widows, you cut her off from possible credit that she needs, perhaps a charity loan. Well, first of all, if this is a pledge for a business loan, you ought not to be doing that with a widow. And if it's a pledge for a charity loan, this is my humble opinion, just give her the money. Just give her the money with no pledge. Don't make her pay back the principal. I imagine that these ambiguities could be litigated in court one way or the other, but I think the general idea is clear, is you take care of the widow because she's poor, just like the poor guy that you couldn't take his cloak overnight when he needed it to sleep in, couldn't take his cloak as security for a loan. It's the same idea. Poor man, poor widow. Look out for the poor. We go to Deuteronomy 24, verses 19 through 22. When you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow, meaning the olives that are beaten down. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, and for the widow. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this thing. God constantly reminds them that they were slaves. In other words, you should feel the pain of poor people because you used to be one. And so aliens, orphans, widows are always looked at under the law. This is repeated over and over again. Now, this idea of not reaping to the corners of the field, well, actually, it doesn't say that. It says, if you've forgotten a sheaf in the field, of a reaped grain like wheat or barley, just leave it there. Don't go back and get it. Now, that's similar to the law in Leviticus 19, 9 through 10. Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. That law is repeated also in Leviticus 23, and it's there in addition to Leviticus 19. So, again, provisions for the poor. It's not going to kill the landowner to lose the gleanings or the stuff in the corners of the field. It's not going to kill him to lose a sheaf that's forgotten as the harvesters walk off the field. Look out for the alien, the orphan, and the widow. Look out for the poor. So verse 19 is just an addition to the laws in Leviticus about reaping fields and leaving stuff over for the poor. Now verse 20 says, when you beat your olive tree, beat it once. Don't go around there and beat every last one of them down so that the poor, the alien, the orphan, and the widow can come back and pick the olive tree. Now, there were three harvest seasons in Israel in the spring. You had the grain harvest in early spring. The barley was harvested in late spring, like around May or June. The wheat harvest, Feast of Weeks, wheat harvest was harvested. The barley harvest was at the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the spring. And then when you get to the summer, right after the wheat was harvested, you had the grapes harvested. And then when you got into the cooler months of the fall, the autumn, the olives were harvested. And the reason I say that is because we see all three harvest products mentioned in these verses. You got verse 19, when you reap your harvest, that's the grain. Verse 20, the olive tree is mentioned. And verse 21, the vineyard is mentioned. In other words, whatever you do, these are all examples. Leave something over for the poor. Ladies and gentlemen, I have now finished with Deuteronomy chapter 24. We are now ready to go to chapter 25. In Deuteronomy 25, we will look once more at various miscellaneous laws and more particularly at levirate marriage. I hope you stay tuned for that audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.